Hi, this is Lindsay Zahn of On Reserve, a wine law blog, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
Hello, and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and the cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with cider makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we have wine law blogger Lindsay Zahn. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. Well, hello, Ciderville. It's awesome to hear that little congo drumming in the background and getting back in the groove with you. If you're not a regular listener of this podcast, well, you might not have known that for the past 2 weeks, I took a little bit of a break to go on my honeymoon and to just kind of like deal with a wedding. So yes, indeed, I did get married in early June, and now I am back. I will just give you a little bit of that scene. There was a lot of cider. The lady was pouring, and then there was two other ciders I made, and there was some craft beer. And just in case you're wondering what there was left and what went out the door, well, no surprise, all the cider was drunk. And that kind of floored me. I don't know if it's because my family and friends are all like, well, Rhea, like, you know, she's all about cider and she really, really loves it. They also know I love craft beer too, no doubt about that. But there was something about cider on a hot June day outside that really met folks' palates and people who don't normally try it. So I was pretty happy about that. And for the regular listeners of this podcast, and those of you who listened to episode number 84, when the Talking Palms took over this podcast, they had been seeing that I was rather maxed out on details and not necessarily able to do everything that I had hopefully planned to do, which I guess is what happens when you're getting involved in the wedding. It's a one time a year when, or one time in your life, hopefully, when you just can't take any more details. And certainly I was at that stretch point. And they went up into my office, took down the recording equipment into the cider house, and let the tape start rolling. In fact, there's a section where I even walked in. Unbeknownst to me, they totally recorded that conversation. So it was tons of fun listening to that chat and having Perry Pear, the Medlars, and Mr. Quince pull it all together. And a big tip of the glass to the Talking Palms for that. Wow, it saved my day. And just getting back to that chat, what it was about was with Charles McGonigal, and it was on the elements of cider, or where he talks about vocabulary and helping people do sensory analysis specific to judging. And then the previous episode was also with Charles, and that was him talking a little bit more about his winery and cidery in Wisconsin, and that's called Apple True. And he also talked about perry making. Yeah! Okay, now, Perry Pear, we know you're excited. That's a little bit of comic relief from Perry Pear, who is in the main control room with Mr. Quince and the Medlars. Anyways, I'm going to continue on, if it's okay with you guys. Yes, and they are nodding. Good, good. Charles, I believe, said it best when he described the following. He said that Perry is its own thing. It is mostly like making a cider. There are a couple of quirks. And don't we know it? Yes, Perry Pears are quite quirky. They're not really eating pears. They are just specific for making Perry. And man, this was a really great piece on it. A lot of how-to wisdom in there. And as such, I had that segment of episode number 83 transcribed. That means that there is now a 10-page transcript on everything that we talked about. So you could go right to that and use it as a resource for your own perry making. And that goes specifically to anyone who is a patron of Cider Chat. And dang, it's such a deal, because if you like this podcast, I'm thinking that you probably think it's worth at least $1 a month for, you know, the service that it offers and all the info it's putting out there, which in turn really super duper helps on this side, just paying the basic bills and hopefully moving the platform forward. So you could check out more about that via the Cider Chat Patreon page. There's a link at ciderchat.com, or just Google a Cider Chat Patreon and you could get a copy of that transcript today. And now it's time to welcome some of the folks who have joined the Cider Chat Facebook page. So a big hello to Ruth. I don't know where you're from, but there's a big old pelican on your cover art. And all I could say about pelicans is if you haven't ever seen them fly in formation along like the coastline, you should really see it. It's like amazing the way they fly in like a perfect form, like a flock of geese. And so low to the ocean water. So they're pretty cool. And then we have Dale, who is from Southern California. And Dale, boy, there is a lot of cider starting to take place in Southern Cal. So we hope to have some of those cideries on in the near future. And then there is Yvonne, who is from the East Coast. And Harold. Harold is another podcaster. He has an animal rescue podcast called Paw Print. That's P-A-W Print. Great guy. He's from based out in California, I should say. And then we have Tony from Texas. And we did have a Texas Cidery on way back when. That was episode 27 with Aaron Anderson of Austin East Cider. So I'm not sure where you're in Texas, but might want to check out those folks. And then we have a kind of like a business page from Mitera, and that's a rural tourist organization in Argentina. So hello, Argentina. And then we have someone from Brazil called Gonçalves. And then we're going to go all the way out to the Czech Republic and welcome Hansa. And then this person, I'm not really sure what your real name is, but what it says is Macau, and you seem like a fun chap, so howdy doody to you, Macau. And then we have another fun name, Big Nose. I've seen Big Nose posting here and there, definitely a cider lover. And we have Jesper from Denmark, Dutch from Illinois. We have Nick and Kimran from out there in the world of cider. And we have Fred, who is founder of Sonoma Cider. Sonoma Cider is based in California, not too far from San Francisco. If you want to hear Dave Cords of Sonoma Cider talk about what they're doing there, you could go to episode number 7, like 007. And then we also have Christopher from Vermont. We have Keith from Portland, Oregon, and Matt from Michigan. And Matt isn't just from anywhere in Michigan. Matt is a cider maker at Townline Cider Works. So how cool is that? I just love it when cider makers join in on the conversation in Cider Chat. And speaking of which, Derek Pletkowski, I want to give you a big old tip of the glass, Derek. He offered his services out to everybody in Ciderville saying, I'll answer any kind of question on apples. He was answering questions about making cider. And this was all in preparation for his comprehensive qualifying exam to become a PhD candidate in pomology. Now, for those who have been listening along to Cider Chat for a while, you might remember that he and Dr. Klein were both on episode number 85. And they did a really nice job of telling us about cider research in Canada. Well, on the Cider Chat Facebook page, he posted, I'll answer these questions. And he did. And that's, a little bit of the flavor that I think Ciderville is all about. Everybody helping each other and kind of sharing information so that we could all both improve our knowledge of cider and certainly improve the quality of cider, both in our own backyard and around the world. So I want to just follow up and give a big tip of the glass to Derek for doing that and congratulate him on becoming a PhD student in pomology. I'm sure we'll be hearing lots more from this guy as time goes on. A really enthusiastic fellow, one of the sweetest guys you can meet. And isn't that great? All the good research that's going on for cider apples around the world. It's fantastic news. So thanks again to everybody who joined in on the Facebook page. And do know it's non-exclusive. You could join too and join in on the conversation. Next up, we're going to be speaking with Lindsay Zahn, who is a wine attorney. She has her own blog on the topic called On Reserve, and it was named one of the top 100 legal blogs by the American Bar Association Journal. There's been articles written about her in the Wall Street Journal, the Law Review, and Wine Business. She really has it going on. She had a lot of information to share. I was super excited that she reached out to Cider Chat and that I could have her on today to give us a little bit of background about the law in regards to beverages such as cider and to talk specifically about cider law. So without further ado, let's all grab a glass and join this chat with Lindsay Zahn, the wine attorney at On Reserve. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast this week, Lindsay. Thank you so much for setting aside some time to have a conversation with Ciderville.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rhea, so much for having me. I'm excited to speak with you as well and talk to Ciderville.
I know a lot of people are probably really leaning their ear into the, maybe their earbuds or the listening in the cars or driving along. This is a really hot topic. The law of governing cider, and of course, your specialty is wine, but I want to start there. What is the similarities or the differences that you might be seeing versus the wine laws and cider laws in the U.S. right now?
Yeah, I think those are some really great questions and an excellent place to start. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, cider is often kind of grouped into this nebulous wine category. And, you know, it might be done a bit purposefully, it might be done a bit accidentally, but the way things look, the way the law looks at cider, it tends to very broadly define it as wine. And understandably, cider is significantly different from wine in both, of course, flavor profile, production, and to some extent, even in terms of regulations. We're seeing a lot of really big changes in the cider world, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners know, with respect to things like permits, licensing requirements, taxation, and labeling and production, but especially on the federal level with respect to things like federal excise taxes and what is cider with respect to excise taxes. Cider is, to some extent, if it falls within the hard cider category for federal excise tax purposes, it's taxed significantly less than wine, so it's always a really great opportunity for especially craft producers, to get their cider into that category as opposed to getting it into the wine category. There are also differences just from cider and wine from a labeling perspective in terms of what you can say, what you cannot say. Generally it does. And this is just from a very, very general perspective. It faces a lot of very similar regulatory requirements and issues that you would normally see with wine. Where it can get a little bit more nuanced, at least what I've seen from my experience, is the state level. I think a lot of states, at some point in time, they may group it. Some states haven't really developed a cider definition. They haven't really developed cider licensing. It's still kind of caught in that very broad general category of wine. But other states, for example, New York, regulate cider a lot differently, perhaps because there is a very significant cider market or there's an opportunity for a very significant cider market to develop. So I think to that extent, we do see a lot of differences on the state level in terms of how cider and wine are regulated, how they're sold, how they can be produced, and the limitations in terms of licensing there as well.
Yeah, that is a pretty broad map that you have to maneuver from the legal aspect. Now, Lindsay, you're based in Virginia, And I know that you have this magnificent blog called On Reserve, and you're teaching in France this summer at a wine law and what is that? The wine law program in Champagne, France. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So I do write a blog on wine law. I started it about 7 years ago. I was still in law school at the time. I was really interested in the idea of wine law, how wine is regulated, and I wanted to kind of explore that passion or that interest by writing a blog, because there really wasn't that much information on the internet at that time with respect to alcohol beverage law or alcohol beverage regulation. And I thought it would be what a great way to essentially explore this idea and learn more about an area of law that I at the time did not know a significant amount about. And since then, I mean, there have certainly been a growth in the number of resources with respect to alcohol beverage law blogs or just alcohol beverage law forums in general. And I think that there are a lot of really interesting forums for cider producers and for other producers of alcohol beverages to seek if they have questions and they need some assistance. There's certainly a lot of material online now. And my original intention was to focus exclusively on wine law, but you know, wine is kind of a very it's a small category in comparison to the overall production of alcohol beverages, and a lot of the general regulatory or legal concerns that that deal with wine also have some influence on malt beverages or beer, as well as distilled spirits. So I don't focus exclusively on wine when I write my blog. I do have pertinent issues that apply to all three commodities, including cider. So I try to focus a little bit more generally now going forward, particularly because I work with clients in all three categories of, at least as TTB recognizes them, all three categories of alcohol beverages. But yes, I do have a blog, and I will be teaching this summer in France at a really great program that helps individuals either in the wine, beer, spirits industry learn more about the legal elements, or law school students who are interested in this area. So it's a very exciting, wonderful opportunity. I taught there about 2 years ago for the program, and it's a great way to get an international perspective as on how alcohol is regulated, what the hot topics are currently on the international side, or in particular countries like Australia or the European Union versus the United States. And, you know, I think it's a really wonderful program for anyone that has the time or interest in attending it.
Great. Yeah, that's so much fun to go to France, too, or well, in my case, there's so much amazing cider and certainly a lot of wonderful wine.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to kind of step back then. Was this interest going towards wine law and now, you know, kind of broadening that perspective? Certainly you hit it right on the mark, because cider in that short period of time has really been booming, certainly both in the U.S. and around the world. What do you tend to reach for, or if I went into your, you know, refrigerator or your grocery bag coming in, might I see some cider coming in, some local ciders? And you don't have to name necessarily a particular cider maker, but what do you tend towards, or do you?
It's funny. So I used to be much more of a wine drinker, especially in my younger years. But I do find myself gravitating much more towards cider, and especially like lighter beers like Pilsner style. But I have a much stronger interest in cider nowadays. I think it's just more drinkable, and it's much more refreshing for me. I mean, every now and then, I certainly do enjoy a nice glass of Montepulciano or Brunello di Montalcino, glass of champagne, absolutely. But for me, cider has just really interesting flavor profiles that you don't always, I mean, you do get interesting flavor profiles with wine, don't get me wrong, but it's to a much different extreme. I've tasted some really extraordinary ciders in the last year or so that have shown me just a lot of dimension that I don't always see in wine. And I think that that's true irrespective of whether or not you've been producing cider for multiple years or if you're just starting out and you're more of a craft producer. I recently had a passion fruit cider. Forget the producer of it, but I bought it. It's one of the local producers, and that one was really incredible too.
Well, that's kind of interesting because that's one of the hot topics in the community of cider makers is the addition of different fruits into the apple base. And I know like the TTB, and I just want to clarify what the TTB is for everybody. That's a Alcohol, Tobacco, Tax, and Trade Bureau. So I'm sure that Lindsay and I will be talking about the TTB a lot, and that's what that stands for. And that's a U.S. government regulation bureau that kind of holds the the paperwork on a lot of licensing and labeling, too, for both wine and cider and across the board. So that piece there is, you know, so hot right now in the U.S. I mean, you came in at a perfect time when there's so much bubbling over with cider versus with wine. It's kind of been, it's been happening for a while, and I'm sure that map has been set in many ways, but your timing is perfect because it's a wide open door and there's so many changes. I wanted to refer to one of your blogs that you wrote back in February, I think it was February 15th, with the TTP issues on the temporary rule modifying federal regulations for hard cider. That's a lot for a cidery to keep up with, all these types of rule changes and just a setup of a cidery. I'm wondering specifically, you know, you have the blog. What kind of service do you provide to a cider maker or a startup cidery looking to get their barrels out rolling to the consumers? What are some of the things that you help with?
It's a really great question. I think one of the best questions to ask, like in terms of starting a cidery, is, you know, what do I need? What should I be looking at? Especially if you're going on the commercial level. Of course, you know, assuming that your state allows it, you are allowed to produce cider for personal consumption, provided that it's for friends and family and it's not for commercial use, meaning it's not being sold. But once you start crossing into that for sale, selling area, you would be regulated by the federal government agency, the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, as well as your local state agency and possibly county or town, depending on where you are located. And there are a lot of things to consider when you are starting a cidery. And probably the first and foremost thing that you would think about is licensing or permitting. On the federal level, you would need a federal basic winery permit with the TTB, the Alcohol Tax and Trade Bureau. And then on the state level, you would also likely need a license, which varies from state to state in terms of the terminology and the particular requirements. Our law firm works a lot with startup or companies that are just starting out to provide guidance on everything from organizing the permit application to submitting it, reviewing it, following up and talking with the TTB specialist it's assigned to. And of course, you know, it might seem, a lot of times you fill out the application and it seems, you know, perhaps a bit straightforward, but many times after months and months of waiting after it's been submitted to the government for review, you work with a specialist who will come back with a list of 20 or more questions that might be somewhat repetitive, or maybe it's somewhat common knowledge to you, but to the specialist, it just wasn't well presented in the application. And of course, it's really time consuming to have to go through that and have to respond to some of those issues or questions that will come up, which is why, from our perspective, it's always great if you can work with someone who's been through this process multiple times. And that's essentially, you know, one of the services that we offer to our clients that are starting up. The other services that we provide to clients who are just getting into the industry that might need some guidance are things like label applications. They're called COLAs, or Certificate of Label Approvals. We help clients file those with the TTB. We help them, we review them before they go in to spot any potential issues. You know, something really unique about the alcohol beverage industry is that all labels have to be reviewed by the federal government before you can actually sell the product at market with the label. So before the product actually gets on a consumer's table, the government has had a significant amount of say as to what you can and cannot say on a label. And some of this is really standard. It's things like alcohol by volume statements, government warning statements, production statement, i.e. like produced by XYZ Cidery. And then other things can be a bit more gray, a bit more vague, of course, because when you're dealing with the government, that's what you inevitably run into. And it can vary from label to label. You know, there can be times when TTB might give you a hard time on a label when you're trying to do something a little bit extreme or a little bit naughty, because their regulations don't want you to do, you know, anything that might be disparaging to a competitor or that might be obscene or indecent. And there's nothing that really defines what obscene or indecent is. So when a specialist looks at the label, they might be offended for a certain picture or through certain language that may appear on the label. I think from my perspective, at least, that TTB has gotten a little bit more liberal and a little bit more lenient on some of these things. But it does depend. They're still certainly not approving cider with weed or cider with marijuana. Mm-hmm. That seems to still be a very contentious topic at this point in time. But, you know, it's hard to say because everyone, the person that reviews the label application, it can vary and everyone has a bit of a different perspective. And even if you work with the same person on a very similar label, they might bring up issues or concerns that were not present previously. So one of the jobs that we at least assist with in terms of labels is basically being an advocate for the clients that we work with and kind of taking this huge burden off their shoulder, especially if they have a label that tends to fall into that gray area that they really, really want to get approved. We also help with things like formulations, getting a formula approved, particularly if you're using like flavors or other products, juices, things like that in a product. We advise on things like trademark, to some extent contracts. If you end up working with a distributor, you might want someone to take a look at an agreement and make sure that the terms listed there are appropriate, that you're properly covered, and just to make sure that, you know, you've kind of considered everything you possibly can when getting into this relationship with a distributor. A lot of times, at least on the distribution side of things, you can be subject to franchise laws. It does vary a lot by state, and even some states might vary it by commodity. Beer might be subject to franchise laws, but cider may not. It's very hard to say. Every state's a bit different, but before you get into a relationship with a distributor you've never worked with, you might want to see if there are any laws that are much more favorable to your distributor in terms of terminating an agreement, as opposed to your company and what your options are if you do decide to terminate that agreement. Those are always, you know, some really interesting things to consider as cider makers grow and expand and go to market and such. And then other than that, we help with a lot of just general compliance matters that come up, things like advertising, social media, which of course is a really big, significant and hot topic right now. Many people don't realize that things like websites and social media are subject to government regulations. It's really important to make sure that your social media usage is within the confines of TTBs, at minimum TTBs. advertising regulations. And then you should also, of course, always check with the state. But social media is definitely an important one these days.
And that is why we have attorneys. It's really important stuff to think about. I first want to just make sure we give the shout out to your law firm that you're part of. What's the name of that firm?
Lehrman Beveridge Law.
Okay. And of course, you provide services for anyone across the U.S. They don't have to just be on one side of the United States or the other.
That's correct. Yes, we have clients in probably almost all 50 states, maybe with the exception of Alaska. But we do represent them before the federal government, and we do assist with state compliance as well.
That's right. And, you know, up in Alaska, they're kind of doing their own thing. So I'm
that is true.
You know, tongue in cheek. I know that there's a new cidery that had just started up there. I'm not sure if there's any others right now. But getting back to what you said, one of the things that I first think of as a business starting up is, you know, it's that licensing and permitting, which I want to get to. But even before that is that piece around trademark. I mean, you put your license and permit in with a name of your cidery, and then, wow, you come back a couple weeks later and find out that actually that name is already trademarked and branded elsewhere. So how do you advise new startups or folks looking to get into this to deal with that at the get-go? Should they look at licensing and permitting first, or that actual branding and securing their name?
It's a very challenging question. It's kind of one of those chicken before the egg situations, or chicken before the egg situations. It's not always that easy to answer, but I think that, you know, at minimum, before you get committed to a name, and this is true with respect to probably even forming your business entity, you really should do some due diligence to make sure that no one else is using this name, at least not in the alcohol beverage realm. It's particularly an issue if you plan to expand and have distribution throughout the United States and not just in let's say, your state. It may be one thing if there's a company that's located in a state that's nowhere near you and is not distributing throughout the U.S. and you have no intention to distribute outside of your state. But if and when either of those companies do, of course, that can cause issue. At minimum, it's probably good to do a clearance search if you are ever interested in trademarking your name, which you probably should. You know, common law, if you are the first user of a particular name, common law will give you some general protection, but federal trademark registration on the United States patent and trade with the United States Patent and Trademark Office will cover you. It's much more of like a blanket authority than common law would be. So I would highly recommend that, you know, once you decide on a name, that you look into having it registered. And then, of course, it's another chicken before the egg or chicken egg situation with that, because the trademark office requires that you are actually using it in commerce, using the mark in commerce. And, you know, it's a question of if you haven't obtained your federal basic permit with the TTB or your state license, you're not actually producing yet, at least not from a legal perspective. At that point, you know, you need to still obtain your license, but in order to legally produce, you need both the license plus the COLA. And then it's a point where you're thinking, well, do I really want to invest in a name that I may not be able to use until I'm actually producing it and using COLAs or using the product in commerce? I mean, at least with the USPTO, you can always file an intent to use application if you are really set on that name and you definitely want to go forward with it, which basically means that you intend to use it in the future. And then if it's approved by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, you have a certain amount of time to show actual use that you're using it in commerce. And that might help forestall some of this process, particularly if you're still at a stage where you're thinking about getting a permit or you're in the process of applying for a permit with TTB. And of course, you know, that's not an easy process. It takes time. It takes time once it's been submitted for it to be reviewed. But that intent to use application might at least buy you some time, and it can be extended even if, let's say, it takes much longer to get the permit than you anticipated, and that will basically halt your production stage to show that you're actually using the mark in commerce. But those are all really good things to consider. Another thing I would say is that as the cider community has expanded in the last few years, you know, people have become more and more litigious with protect and much more fierce with protecting their marks. And this is true irrespective of whether or not the product's a cider, it's a wine, it's a beer, it's a spirit. There are certainly producers out there that may be producing a distilled spirit, and you might think it has nothing to do with cider. But if it has a name that is exactly the same as yours, or, you know, likely to cause confusion, it's very possible that they could come after you and that they may have prior rights to that mark, even if it's just similar and likely to cause confusion. These are all really good questions to think about and certainly consider before you are filing, you know, these applications and committing to a brand name that you certainly probably are excited to start marketing and putting on social media and, you know, putting up a sign. But these are all things that you definitely should consider, because the concern certainly down the line is, even if there isn't an issue right away, there could always be someone that's trying to protect their mark years down the line, and you might have to redo all of your branding if they had prior rights to that mark in commerce. So that's always a significantly scary part, I think, for a lot of business owners too.
Yeah, I want to just tell the listeners right now to exhale and take a good slow breath in. You're going to be okay with everything you just heard Lindsay said. I know that could sound really daunting. I'm wondering if like a little hack around this would be to get your like tax ID number secured. I mean, because that's a little bit of an, you know, kind of open area. What is actually being in commerce? You could have that and start doing your branding. I wouldn't recommend probably like doing it as a doing business as, you know, tax ID. Maybe get like an LLC or something and start that process. Would that be like a hack around this whole piece of at least getting your trademark or your mark secured at some level before jumping right into the licensing and permit?
You probably don't want to talk about a hack. Yeah. It's certainly something that might be worth considering, but from my experience and my understanding, it actually has to be used in commerce. There has to be legal use of it in commerce. And that our interpretation has generally been that it extends to actually selling it, as opposed to just registering an LLC. It's always a concern that in the future, you know, someone could always attack the fact that you submitted a registration and it wasn't actually being used yet in commerce. So that might be a concern if you aren't producing at that point. But there may be, you know, some possible loopholes, depending on the particular situation.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So everybody's breathing again. There's a lot of open doors here and it's going to be okay. That's why we have folks like Lindsay. I wanted to get back to that piece around social media, because that really kind of, you know, made my ears kind of perk up there. What are some of the things that one should be paying attention to when promoting their product on social media, especially in this area of alcohol?
I think that's a really, really good question. So there are a lot of advertising regulations that are found in 27 CFR Part 4. And I know that might be a little bit nerdy, but those are essentially, that's where you would find more information if you are curious in regard to advertising of wine. And it will apply to cider, because from TTB's regulatory perspective, cider falls within the wine category. And it lists some of the mandatory information that needs to appear on advertisements, which are things like the name of the responsible advertiser, as well as their city and state or their address that appears on their federal basic permit, which is the document that's issued once you obtain your permit with TTB. And usually the city and state is fine. You don't have to put the full address, as well as like the name of the company. And then you need to include things like the class type of the particular product that you're advertising. And that could be anything from table wine to cider to fruit wine, whatever the product might be. And there are some exceptions. You don't necessarily have to include all of that information if you have like an entire line of products that you're advertising. Our general interpretation, at least from a social media perspective, has been, you know, you don't necessarily have to put the name and your city state on every single post that you put on, let's say, your Facebook or your Instagram, as long as it's in like the general profile tab. It's usually like the front page or the more information about the company. So you can include a lot of that information there. But you should certainly be aware of anything in regard to obscene or indecent content, which again is kind of a gray area, but I wouldn't post anything that might be, you know, for only certain audiences, particularly on a public forum. It might be one thing if it's tongue in cheek, but you know, something that's really disgusting or disturbing is probably something that would raise some eyebrows. There are some other concerns, such as, you know, making claims on a label, maybe something like gluten free, making claim of gluten free on the advertisement that was not necessarily approved on the actual label itself by TTB. So if you make a claim like that on the advertisement and it's not approved on the label, that could raise some concern. So I would just be careful that any advertising or claims that you make on the advertisement itself is consistent with what's actually been approved on the label. And that brings up kind of a good point too. You know, I know I mentioned previously that labels actually have to be approved by the TTB, and that is certainly true. They have to go through an entire process, be submitted, be reviewed, be commented on, and before you can actually get like the approval, the approved label, the COLA in hand. But advertisements have no formal review process, and that's kind of significant because it puts a huge burden on industry. It puts a huge burden on the manufacturer to make sure that the content that they're putting out there is accurate, it's truthful, it's not misleading, and that, you know, no one's going to be offended by it. One of the other things I've been seeing a lot recently, too, on social media is I see a lot of manufacturers naming particular retailers or carriers of the product, or saying, you know, tag your favorite retailer in this photo or, you know, something to that extent. And I think that has the potential to bring up some concerns on the Tidehouse level. We saw something happen a few years ago in California with the Grape Escape. It was a particular wine or trade conference, where a lot of wineries were advertising on Twitter that they were attending this Grape Escape, and the California ABC had some concern with some Tidehouse issues because I believe the Grape Escape was funded or it was done in part with a particular retailer. So they thought the California ABC had issued some concern to these manufacturers that they might be in violation of California Tidehouse regulations, mainly because a tweet that they had issued online mentioned the Grape Escape. So those are always just some things to be aware of. I would always, you know, if you're going to post anything online that refers to retailers or ask consumers to tag retailers, I would run it by your counsel or in at least, take a review of both the federal advertising laws for alcohol along with the Tide House laws and your state compliance or your state regulations to make sure that it doesn't run afoul of any of those particular regulations. Because I think that that is a big concern there and something to be at least aware of, if not proactive about too. So those are just some of the concerns that I've seen recently on social media.
Right. Can you were saying Tide House? Is that how I'm hearing that correctly?
Yes.
And what does that mean, Tide House?
So Tide House, it's a really good question. Tide House it's a concept that developed around the Prohibition era, where a lot of manufacturers were essentially inducing retailers to carry their product or somehow tying them to them, whether it be by providing some sort of items, free items, or money, or just basically enticing them to buy only their particular product from that manufacturer to the exclusion of other products, basically saying, buy my product, don't buy this other guy's product, I will give you X, Y, and Z. That was something that really grew right around the Prohibition era. And once Prohibition was repealed, there was significant industry concern that this idea of Tide House would continue in the industry. So since then, both federal governments and state governments have passed laws to curtail this idea of Tide House, where there is some sort of either manufacturer and to some extent even wholesaler influence over a retailer that basically encourages or forces the retailer to push a certain product or carry only a certain product. And it's essentially, it's giving a benefit or an unjust benefit to a retailer. And usually it includes this idea of exclusion, where the retailer will not buy or cannot buy any other brand of alcohol, whether it be competitors or, another type of alcohol product. And essentially the manufacturer is going to take up like the shelf space and exclude other products from it. So very minor things have been considered to be potential Tide House violations. And in some states like California, you have to be careful because there isn't this element of exclusion. So you can be found to be in violation of the state Tide House law, even if there is no exclusion to begin with, because it's not one of the elements that are required to be found in violation of Tide House. So just basically conferring a benefit on a retailer could be illegal. There are, of course, many exceptions. California has a lot of carve outs that a lot of times actions of manufacturers or wholesalers may fall into. Things like, to some extent, maybe providing paraphernalia for the bars, like if it's a clock or if it's like particular coasters or something, those might be okay. It just kind of depends. But it's concerns basically of like salt and peppering the retailer so that they have, every incentive to purchase only this one product or only from a particular distributor, and tying them to that producer or to that distributor.
Wow. Okay. You're talking about Twitter, and I'm thinking about Twitter is such a hot topic right now. And of course, I don't see any of these problems out there in Ciderville. I just see everybody sharing their good news and good cheer, and they're happy that they got a certain bottle released. Their apple tree has gotten pruned. It's kind of a jovial atmosphere to be in. And I suspect that the government has a lot of responsibility looking right now at Twitter and how it's being used in our government system. So I don't know if they're going to be spending that much time in Ciderville, because there's certainly a lot of international Twitter tweets to be watching for. But that's a little off topic, but I have to mention that because it feels like there's just so much pressure put on really, you know, cider makers are artists in many ways. They're a maker. They have this craft, and then you have to kind of come to this realization that, my goodness, you are now in the legal confines in many ways of the system. And getting back to that advertising piece, I suspect you might know who Dan Shelton is of the Shelton Brothers. And that reminds me of when they were importing the beer Santa's Butt from overseas. And the TTB was saying, you can't do that because Santa Claus is on the label. And it's going to be, you know, for children, it's not a good thing. And of course, they didn't. He was able to kind of swing that around and actually get it approved, because butt is actually a unit of measurement in the UK that is used for beer. So he has done a lot of pushing that envelope in the beer world. And I know the Shelton Brothers are now importing cider at a much higher rate than they ever have. So these kind of areas, those set in law, I think, and I'm wondering if you agree, I think it's good to know that there might be a law, but laws are made to kind of evolve and change with the climate. Would you see that as a truth, or what's your feelings on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's a really great example of something that probably, when it was submitted to TTB for review, it probably got kicked back with one of the reviewers saying that it was inappropriate or obscene or indecent or misleading or likely to, whatever their comment may have been. And I think that that's one of the examples of, first of all, I don't think that any of the needs corrections that come back from TTB, and barring some exceptions, but I think that a lot of them can be arguable, particularly if you really want a label or a product to appear a certain way. I think it's a matter of crafting a good, solid, decent argument. In this case, it seems like he certainly did. And I think that that probably had a significant leverage in getting the label approved. The other thing, you know, at some point in time, it was probably very taboo to even include just a normal Santa Claus on a beer label or a cider label, because it appealed to children, it appealed to minors. And we've seen a lot of movement away from that. We've seen a lot more labels approved that have Santa Claus or that have, you know, other types of figures that may appeal to children. And so I think that there is a movement to some extent there as well, and just in terms of maybe it's a different regulator or it's a different regime. They've kind of been more flexible, you know, on certain areas that they have not necessarily been so in the past.
Now, you're working in the U.S., you're traveling internationally, and there is, you know, this trade that goes back and forth between the different countries. And going specifically to France, you know, they have their appellations for their certain product, like champagne. No one else can call something champagne. It has to be from that region. Calvados is another product that can only be called Calvados if it's from France and made, and even there, you know, they have a very, very defined way to do that. But one particular name and product that I see used also in the U.S. is the name Pamu. And I was speaking to Didier Bidou, who's a president of the Appellation Control for Cider, Calvados, and Pamu in France, and he was saying that shouldn't be used in the U.S., that's actually under the French appellation and control. Would you have any info on that? Because I know different cideries kind of throw that out. What we've done in the U.S. is we use the term apple brandy instead of Calvados. But I know the French have a lot of feelings about the Pamu because, you know, they're very strict. It has to be in a barrel for 18 months and certain properties that they're judging that by. And yet we're seeing certain products being released in the U.S. that are also using that name, Pamu, which don't necessarily follow that same criteria that they're using in France?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know too much about the actual concern or legislation in regard to Pomerou, but I can talk generally about United States and the use of foreign appellations. In the U.S., there are essentially three categories or so that recognize different level of protection. You have like generic names, generic terms, which can be used on wine irrespective of where it's produced. You have semi-generic names. Those are things like champagne, port, Marsala, Claret, Chianti, Burgundy to some extent. And those are terms that in the United States today can be used with some limitation. Usually if COLA, a certificate of label approval, was issued to a very specific producer by a certain point in time, and I don't recall the exact date, but it's within the last several years, anyone who applies for a label application after that, whether it be even the same producer that had a semi-generic name on it and changes the label itself so that it's a lot different, or a brand new applicant who has never used that term on the label, they are restricted from using terms like champagne or Chianti or Chablis, et cetera, on the label. So that's like kind of the middle ground of protection. And then you have your non-generic distinctive, which is basically something that's highly protected on the international level, that's recognized by the United States. United States essentially says, this type of wine or this type of spirit can only come from this location. It has to follow the regulations, the laws of production, of bottling, etc., of that particular location. No one in the United States can use that term. That's not okay. So I'm not sure exactly where Pomerou falls in that spectrum. I do agree that it is a term that's recognized in France. I have seen it on a few labels in the United States. So I'm not 100% certain what the international tensions are with that particular term. But it's certainly something that I think is worth my looking into and maybe even writing a bit more about once I can find some more information. So I think you've given me some inspiration for a future blog post.
Excellent. Yeah. I'd love to hear a follow-up on that, because these are some of the areas that, and certainly as cider makers are traveling about around the world, whether they're listening to Cider Chat or actually doing that physical travel. And it's a worldwide community, and I suspect you see that within the wine community too. I mean, there can be certainly like the California region of winemaking and the Virginia region, and then you have like Burgundy and Riesling, you know, all these types of areas, Bordeaux, kind of being segregated in a way, but in the greater scheme, it's all one world, and the more we kind of work together to help each other promote, it really makes the most sense in my mind.
Yes, I agree. I think that's a really good, strong, fair point. I think also the more we know and understand about, you know, how these terms are regulated, how they're defined, even from an international perspective, I think it will help our producers going forward too. And even just from your perspective of respect and development of maybe their own terminology or their own style, I think that will be helpful as well.
Which brings me to one other area that I wanted to kind of cover with you today, which is that piece on vintage. Now, wine is able to use vintage, and I know that this is a regulation with the U.S. government, but are you seeing any kind of traction there or ways for the associations in the U.S. and, you know, we have the United States Association of Cider Makers and different guilds in each state. But this is a real drawback for makers, because apple is a yearly crop that comes in that way. What are your thoughts on that? I'm not sure if this is like kind of your specialty, but I imagine in the realm of putting vintage on the label, we know that's a no-no. I mean, that's not supposed to really happen. Mm-hmm. There might be some ways to get about that. But is there a way for some of these associations to kind of start pushing that as an option? Because it would really make a big difference, both for the consumers to kind of know. I mean, certainly we might buy wine based upon vintage, but also for mm-hmm. the producers too. What's your thoughts on that?
So I'm a very strong advocate of truth in labeling. I think that the consumers should know as much information as they need to know about the production of a product before making a purchase. They should be informed. I think that that's really the I think that's the direction that our society is heading in. I think that's true because you see things to some extent on voluntarily on some labels, just in terms of calorie counts, carbohydrates. I mean, producers, generally speaking, unless the product falls under 7% alcohol by volume, either cider or wine, producers are not required to put nutrition contents or nutrition facts or calorie contents or anything. But I think that some of them are voluntarily doing it, or at least including things like ingredient statements. I see that a lot. I think Ridge Winery is one of the producers that voluntarily does it out in Sonoma. And I think that we are kind of heading in that direction. I see no issue with why vintage year should not be allowed for a cider. I think it's, you know, it's a crop. It's just like grapes. If it's been harvested a certain year, you know, what is the harm in doing that? And I think maybe one argument there for some of these trade associations is also to look to see, first of all, it's allowed on wine. But second of all, it's also allowed to some degree, maybe not vintage per se, but to some degree, it's allowed on certain distilled spirit products, you know, aged X years. I mean, that's a good idea as to how long a product, how old a product is, how long it's been in a barrel or how long it's been aged. You can also say something like removed from the cellar X year on spirits label, or, you know, it's harvested in X year. And I think that those are significant comparisons. Why can't the cider community make a similar statement on a label?
Yeah, it's something that I do think we're going to see in time, and we need a clear voice to really bring that forward. You know, there's so many great areas out there with cider right now. I had one group in from Tennessee that was a Gypsy Circus Cider Makers, and they were the first cidery to start up in Tennessee. Now there's a couple more. But at that point, the state of Tennessee, it was kind of like the Wild West, and yet they had Strongbow. Smith and Forge is being produced there. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't really kind of equate that with actual craft cider, the government. So these are the areas. I mean, we really need folks like yourself to be out there kind of having this large overview, just so we could just get on with making cider and getting it to the market. It's hard enough just doing that. Never mind all these laws and regulations. So I could talk to you all day, Lindsay. I hope we have the opportunity to have you back on again. I know this is going to really give the listeners out there in Ciderville a lot to think about. I might feel like a lot of kind of attorney talk, but I think you did a wonderful job today, speaking clearly and in a language that certainly I could follow. So if I could follow it, anyone could follow it.
Well, that's good to hear, because I know sometimes being a lawyer or having to deal with regulations is not the most exciting area, but I think as a lawyer I can say I really do love what I do, and not all lawyers can say that. But I certainly hope that it's been helpful, and you know, I'm more than happy to connect with anyone who might have other questions or might just need a clarification on something that was said, in case I rambled too much. No, because I do get excited about this.
No. You did a great job. And I really will have all the links to your information on the show notes. And I want to really encourage listeners to subscribe to her, Lindsay Zahn's blog On Reserve. And it's a bounty of information, both nationally, internationally, and to just to follow along your journeys. You're really stepping into a marvelous career here, full steam ahead, and lots of alkaloids to you, everything that you've done. I appreciate your time here today on Cider Chat with all of us.
Thank you, Rhea. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate that you were willing to let me come on.
Wasn't she just the bee's knees? Lindsay is just so approachable, and that's exactly the kind of person we want out there in Ciderville, helping new cidery startups. If it's a cidery startup or a cider bar, what have you, even if you're a podcaster like myself. We need folks like this on the team and able to assist us when that question comes up on what should I do or should I do this. So kudos to her, and all the info is on the show notes and the links on how you could contact Lindsay and certainly to subscribe to her On Reserve wine blog. Ciderville, it's time to announce the two folks who were entered into the giveaway for a pair of tickets to the Cider Circus at the Copper Mountain Ski Resort in Colorado. That's taking place on August 26. And their names are Joe and Jennifer. Man, oh man, oh, that's going to be a good time. You know, the folks who put this on is the Gypsy Circus Cider Company in Tennessee, and that's Stephanie and Aaron Carson. If you want to hear more about them and the circus, go to episode number 81 at Cider Chat. You can find Cider Chat wherever you download your podcasts, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, they're actually calling it now Apple Podcasts. And please make sure you let your friends know that there is a cider-centric podcast out there for anyone who needs a little bit more cider to fill that glass. So happy that you came along with the journey with me this week. It's great to be back chatting with you, Ciderville. A lot more to come, some amazing places out there in the world to visit with all of you. This is Rhea Wincoller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Going up.
Yeehaw!